join me in welcoming Duncan to Western Engineering. Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you very much for the invitation to speak today. I think I'll take my jacket off because I want to be less formal than I would suggest. So what I thought, I was told, you know, you can come and talk to a group of students and some faculty members on a topic of your choosing. And no surprising, I chose a topic that had the nuclear word in it somewhere. So what I thought I'd do is talk to you a bit about what's happening in the world generally with respect to nuclear power plants. Give you some ideas on how nuclear fits into the overall supply mix across the world, what's changing the fortunes of nuclear, and also talk to you a lot about some of the challenges that the industry faces. It's quite an exciting time to be in the industry, but I always tell people that opportunity and risk travel on the same transport. You know, you have a situation where the industry has a lot of opportunity, but its ability to deliver it, actually, it is threatened by a lot of concerns about the speed of growth and development. Your nuclear power plants actually appearing in countries that have never had nuclear before, and some of the challenges that come with just the life cycle of the existing plants. So I'm not a kind of formal guy at all, so at any point if anyone wants to stop and ask, don't worry about breaking my thread of concentration because it's easily broken at the best of times. So don't worry about stopping and asking. I always tell people, you know, when I talk to our staff about what we've been doing as a company, I always start by telling them the same thing about nuclear power. We are nuclear, no one likes us, and we don't care. It's a good way to look at the world because, you know, I'm going to show you some stuff. I'm going to talk about the future of the industry. But make no mistake, that doesn't mean that everyone thinks we're now warm and cuddly. It's more about options are few. And, you know, we have to find a way to make the whole thing fit together. But the concerns that people have about nuclear power have not gone away. They will never go away, in my view. And all the industry can do is talk a bit more openly about how it's performing and how it's managing those risks that people very seldom fully understand. So, I don't even know what's on these slides, so I'll be surprised when I look at them as much as you will. Let's talk a bit about the global energy factors. None of this is particularly surprising to you. There is continuing to be a requirement for energy. One quarter of the world's population live in energy poverty, even to this day. You know, it's obvious when you look across the developing countries that their need for energy will continue to grow and grow at quite a significant rate. So that's one of the factors we should remember. Of course, other things that people have, for a whole set of reasons, is security of supply concerns, control of their own domain, recognising that energy is a very important part of the infrastructure of any country. Countries are politically concerned about a dependency on other countries for such a vital component. And so, you know, people are all starting to think now about what do we have within our own boundaries and within our own control. And again, there's an issue about that. With respect to the nuclear industry itself, there are 440 plus reactors in the world right now. There's about 30 of them under construction, and I'll show you where those are. But many of the plants that were built, if you think about the generations that are in operation now, sort of early to 70s to, you know, maybe early 80s, those plants were all built. And so the infrastructure that we have right now, this is not just about generating plants, but it's also about transmission and all the other things of the developing countries are actually putting in new. We are actually having to think now about reinvesting in that infrastructure, not a small order. I mean, even in Canada, we'll talk a bit more about Ontario later, you will see some pretty big numbers bandied about just to keep our infrastructure going, not to double its capacity, just to keep it going for the next 20, 25 years, and I'll talk about that. One of the key things to note also is when nuclear plants were first built, in fact, in many cases when they still continue to be built, they are being built in a regulated environment, some form of regulated control cost recovery mechanism. most of the plants that are in operation right now, particularly in North America, are actually operating as merchant nuclear plants. And the interesting thing about that is never has a nuclear plant ever been built in a merchant environment. So we'll talk a bit about, you know, what the market design changes is doing to the industry as a whole, because it is a factor if we talk about building new ones. You'd have to be on a different planet not to hear about climate concerns. You can't pick up a paper anywhere now where there isn't talk about climate change and the effect on the environment and the need for us to actually be more responsible. So obviously if you're in a nuclear field, you're able to say, you know, we are emission free. And for me, that's one of the major drivers for nuclear being back and on the table as a real viable option. Interesting thing is, when you ask the general public, what are your preferences for energy supply? And maybe you guys share that same preference, because it's pretty dominant. What would you like to see for energy supply? People will say solar, wind, hydraulic. You go pretty far down the list before they say anything that starts with an N. So, you know, there is this kind of feeling that the sun shines, the rain falls, and the wind blows, and that should be enough. Why do we need all this more complex stuff? But having said all of that, you ask people if they fancy a windmill in a back garden, you have a very different answer. So there is this kind of interesting dilemma where emotionally people seem to favour those kind of technologies, but actually they don't really want to see them next door. I have said, you know, you can tell from my accent I'm originally from the UK, despite my Bruce County accent that's overlaid on top of it. The reality is the UK went for renewables in a big way, but if you were to go there today with the intention of building a wind farm, you'd be hanging on it by noon, because people have reached saturation point. And so there is a degree of tolerance. Another great example of that, I was talking to Don Eller, he was saying he's come up to see our wind farm. We've got a small wind farm at our site, 6 of them, 9 megawatts. When we first went to build that, it was hailed as a tourist attraction. People would come from far and wide to see the Huron wind farm. Here we are 5 years on, and Enbridge are trying to build a 200 megawatt wind farm and meet an incredible local opposition to it. So there is a tolerance level where 5 or 6 of them, yeah, it sounds okay. 120 of them, oh, I don't think so. So there is a recognition of scale, and yet if wind is going to make the kind of inroads that even in Ontario are expecting to make, there are going to have to be a number of pretty large wind farms developed in Ontario. And you know, from what I've seen in our Bruce County area, that is not going to be easy to deliver. So I think if you look at all of those things, you can see what the global environment looks like. This graph gives you a sense, you know, all of you smart students can actually put your ruler on top of that line and draw where that's heading. That's a global demand for energy, you know, and it's not looking to ease anytime soon. So you can see a massive growth in energy demand. And the obvious question is, what fills that gap? What's going to do that for us? I mentioned earlier, you know, no one likes us. So this is what public opinion looks like. The only thing less popular than nuclear is coal, and that's in Ontario particularly. There's parts of the US where there's a very clear mandate to build coal plants at a very significant rate. If you went to India and China, you'll see massive coal construction going on. And of course, here in Canada, we've got very, very large coal reserves. We were talking earlier about the oil sands. You know, many orders of magnitude greater than the amount of oil there is the amount of coal that's there. Tremendous coal reserves. So it's kind of really hard to turn your back on those indigenous resources and do something else. So although coal is unpopular as an energy supply, it's incredibly flexible. So there is going to have to be some recognition of the need for coal, even if there is concern about climate, which is why you hear people talking about clean coal technology and other things. But as I say, you know, the fact that nuclear is back on the radar, it's more about the graph showing demand and recognition that even though solar and wind may be the most in favour, they don't have anything like the scale of these two. And that's really when it comes down to those people that can do the math understand that, yes, we should try and use some of this in a mix, but in terms of its volume, we really have to consider the most unpopular ones. And isn't it funny that the ones that are the least popular are the ones that are most productive? Isn't that always the way of it? It's sort of like chocolate being the thing you enjoy most, and it's the least healthy. That's just the way the world is, I'm afraid. But we are seeing signs of environmentalists starting to recognise nuclear. James Lovelock, a very well-known environmentalist, one of the founders of Greenpeace, actually actively now talking about nuclear power. He's actually a bit of a doom merchant in my view, because he tells everyone we're already too late. We're already too late. We've done irreparable damage to the environment, and what we need to do now is build a society that can live with that damage, because we can't actually recover from it. So it's nice to hear him say nuclear is a good thing, but it's kind of scary when he puts out there and say, but we're already too late. But nonetheless, he's an example. And, you know, Patrick Moore, another person, founder of Greenpeace, very actively talks about nuclear power now. So we are seeing some of those things changing. Mentioned before, just in terms of what nuclear is, nuclear is, say, 440 reactors in the world, number of them being built right now. 16% of the world, in fact 60% of Canada's border where it is, but you can see the number of countries that are involved. And as I said, big issue about the ageing of those units. Just to give you a sense, there's been a lot of talk, and you know, we're going to have more of that dialogue here in Ontario about which kind of reactors, if we're going to build new ones, which should they be. Obviously, there's a range of types of reactors. The most dominant one is, well, most dominant type is light water reactors, pressurized water reactors being the most dominant, and boiling water reactors. UK, typically, you know, you guys are all engineers, so you know that engineers don't like to build two things the same. That's not interesting enough. So even in this family here, there are a wide range of designs. So look at that and say, well, all 94 of those BWRs are the same, and we share a common design model, because we don't. And that's true all the way through these. Even when we look at CANDU reactors, very different range of designs in it. But you can see the split. And if you ask me how I think new build's going to work, I think it's going to split broadly along the same percentages. I don't think any, although I believe the light water reactors will still dominate any new plants, I think there'll still be a mix of those. I mentioned the number of reactors that have been built right now. I'll show you that in another graph in a moment. But the most significant growth in nuclear plant, and in fact in any energy, is not surprising in those countries that are growing at a significant rate. China, India, Russia particularly, very, very active. I was in Beijing, maybe 6 weeks ago, and the energy minister was talking about their program, and he said, we're going to commission 4 reactors per year for the next 10 years. We want to start slowly to begin with. And I'm thinking, 4 reactors per year, you know, it's an incredible rate of development. And at the same time, build 20,000 megawatts of coal. So massive development, and the same is true in India. And Russia, of course, developing not only for their own use, but actually selling their technology in other places like Iran, competing in China, other places to sell their technology. This graph's kind of busy and not that easy to read here, but one of the interesting things is, of course, there are some countries who are known for their dependency on nuclear. France, one of the most significant ones, massive nuclear program. An interesting thing about France, I'm going to sound like a world traveller, but I was at a presentation where the French energy minister was talking about their energy program, and he can lay on one diagram their energy plan till 2060. They have it all laid out. They're running Generation 2 plants now. They're going to commission a Generation 3 reactor in 2020. And then they're going to build a Generation 4 reactor in 2035. They just continually migrate their technology. So I always tell people, you know, if you're in a nuclear business, you have to have that long-term view. And there are very few countries that have it. France has had it for a long time. And you're no surprise to me that you don't hear a lot about energy shortages and issues in France, because they actually have a long-term plan. Therein lies one of the issues for our industry. Nuclear plants, nuclear operators can do nothing quickly. You know, we need time, we need a long planning horizon. And, you know, typically that makes it tough. But the interesting thing about this diagram as well is if you look at some of these names, where they're written at zero at the moment, these are countries that have said they are going to pursue the use of civil reactors for peaceful use. If you look at the names, Switzerland, Turkey, Vietnam, Kazakhstan, Indonesia, Iran, you're starting to see some countries that actually there are a lot of issues about them having technology. There are a lot of issues, geopolitical issues, about actually operators sharing experience together. We mentioned earlier, the World Association of Nuclear Operators. We were formed after the Chernobyl event in 1986. The whole intent of that was to say every nuclear operator in the world will work together to share experience, knowledge, so that we never have an event like that again. And, you know, Lasley Wanham has been very successful in the last 20 years. But now we're starting to look at political destabilization in areas where it's very difficult. A great example of that would be, and this is kind of right on my desk right now, Iran are actually in the process of looking for a group of peer evaluators from other world nuclear operator plants to come to their facility and help them with their commissioning plans for their reactor. Now, I mentioned there's 440 reactors in the world. You know, 120-ish of them are in, 130 are in North America. So the most dominant operating experience is here. Now, what chance do you think I've got of going to the US Department of Energy and saying, I'd like to bring 15 nuclear operators from the US to go to Iran to help them to commission their reactor? It's not a very optimistic option to us. So you have an issue where even though the industry wants to work together to make sure we're consistent in our behaviours, it's becoming increasingly difficult and will become more difficult as more and more countries actually move into the nuclear end. That is one of the challenges for the industry. Because another piece of this, if you recognise the two events that the industry is always remembered for, Three Mile Island and Chernobyl, both of them actually come from very inexperienced and immature nuclear programs. Three Mile Island, when the plant was actually being commissioned, with a lot of inexperienced operators. And Chernobyl, which was really an ill-planned experiment with a lot of systems. So if you look at that and say, as you go through the life cycle of operation, you guys will know this too, you know, you have this kind of infant mortality rate, and then you have a period of steady operation. That's what the industry has seen. Your early days when we had some lack of knowledge and expertise in the industry, and we had new technology and new plant, were more error prone. Here we are for the last 15, 20 years, steady state operation. The performance of all the plants has got significantly better. But we're now moving into another cycle with new designs and new staff and inexperience. And that, as an operator of the industry, that's a period of high risk for us. We, you know, at WANO, we always talk about if a nuclear event occurs in any plant, it occurs in every plant, because you feel the effect of that. There's no doubt that North America felt the effect of Chernobyl in terms of willingness to go and develop the technology. So we have to be aware of that risk, and we have to be prepared to manage it. This slide really just explains the light shade on it is actually a record of those countries that are actually building now. So you can see pretty widespread across the world in terms of who's investing in what, and, you know, as I say, the dominant one being China there, where you can see a significant development. Just to make my point on reactor operation, over time, you know, the capacity factor, and this is back to my diagram about wind and solar and all those things, the capacity factor of nuclear plants, you know, you look at Canada's there, 78.4%. This is a 3-year rolling timetable where the plants are off or plant shutdowns in between that. But you're actually looking at your pretty high performance from nuclear plants generally, in mid to upper 70s. You don't get anything like that from, I mean, our wind farm at Huron Wind is 24% capacity factor, and that's reckoned to be a pretty good one. So in terms of, you know, reliable baseload power, emission-free, then it's no surprise that nuclear's been looked at. And its operational performance is pretty strong and pretty uniform across the world. The interesting thing is, you look at the places that are building, they are not building from a position of, you know, being the best performers. But look at Finland. The first people in the developed Western world to order a nuclear reactor, Finland. Because in reality, the operational performance of the plants put them into consideration. They put themselves in the game because of strong performance, and these Finnish reactors are amongst the best in the world and have been right from the beginning. Interesting to see how politicians work. I can tell you, you know, the issue I've talked about before is that nuclear is a kind of long-term decision, yet politicians deal with kind of retail politics. I'm elected for 4 years, what can I do that gets me elected for the next 4 year term? Kind of thing. I know that sounds cynical, but that's the way it works. It is the way it works. But what you're actually seeing is some more positive statements coming out. You see here in Canada that there's a recognition from our energy minister here in Ontario that he knows he needs it. It is the backbone of the industry. 50% of Ontario right now is nuclear power. And it's, you know, simple. I say the same thing all the time. Every second school, house, factory, hospital, university is powered by nuclear power today. If you don't want it, fill in a blank. So if you do want it, actually there's a very significant investment required just to hold it where it is, and I'll show you some of those numbers. Of course, in the US, George Bush, concerned about security of supply, concerned about oil and the ability of the dependency on oil, is starting to put in place a lot of things in the US. You think a lot about his foreign policy and all those things, but at home, the energy policy is heavily investing in hydrogen and technology of the future, building coal plants, creating incentives for people to build nuclear plants, and looking for ways to actually migrate the US from oil. And it's similarly true in other places. You know, the UK is a great case study, because if you're in politics long enough, you actually come back to own some of the problems. You know, Tony Blair's been in long enough, 10 years now, actually he can't escape the situation. I can tell you, you know, I was there when he was first elected, and there was no way he was having any more nuclear plants. Labour were elected on a platform of, we're not going to do that anymore, we're going to do renewables, solar, wind, we're going to do all those things, conservation. Some of this is going to sound really familiar here in Ontario, because when Tony Blair came in, he said, I am going to meet my Kyoto target. The UK will be a world leader. We will meet Kyoto before anyone else. And they did. They actually built a lot of wind farms. They changed their whole profile and supply. And he said, we'll never build nuclear. Here he is, 10 years down the line. Someone's doing the math for him. And he realises he can't stay there. He will not meet Kyoto for the next 5 years going forward. And he understands that without the nuclear contribution, not only will he not meet Kyoto, but he doesn't have any energy. And so what he actually has to do is not just reverse his position in speeches, he has to actually accommodate the fact that all the regulatory approvals that the industry needs, he doesn't now have time for. He's going to have to find an expedited way. So it's not so much, I've changed my mind on nuclear, it's more, I've changed my mind on nuclear, and I'm not giving you a chance to express your view, because we don't have time. And so it is interesting to see how the world views this thing. Say, France has always been on board with nuclear, and are now going to, you know, take the lead. They're sailing very heavily internationally, their capability. Finland's building now, so say Russia and China, big build programs. I mentioned before the new entrants, and you know, you can see some of the areas that are actively looking at it. And this is going to get really interesting. Because there is competition to sell these new reactor designs. You know, people like AECL are keen to sell their designs internationally. Arriva, French design, very active. Westinghouse and GE, all looking for share of this market, yet some concerns about some of these countries actually having nuclear programs. And I expect that to get really interesting over the next 5-10 years. In Canada, I mentioned we've got 16% of the overall supply mix, very, very much a dominant position in Ontario here, where most of the nuclear plants are. There is one in New Brunswick and one in Quebec, both of which are due for refurbishment. It's been agreed that New Brunswick will actually proceed. In fact, it's planned for 09, and Quebec is going through hearings right now. So very much a view that, that we'll continue to do that. But one of the interesting things, Ontario is already committed to nuclear. Canada is actually in a bit of a time warp in some ways. In the, if you go to both of the bookends of the country, you go to BC, lots of hydraulic. Don't talk to me about nuclear, I'm not interested, it's not politically acceptable. The same's true in Newfoundland. In fact, I think it's illegal for uttering the word nuclear in Newfoundland. But someone told me, you know, don't come here and mention that word because we can lock you up for it. So it's interesting to see that. Now, it's easy to take that high ground when you've got lots of water and you don't have that. But the truth is, if you go to BC right now, they're starting to talk about gas plants. Because actually their economy's picking up big time. They're starting to realise that with a growing economy comes a higher energy requirement. And actually they're starting to exhaust the hydraulic that they had. So even now they're thinking about gas plants. Quebec, another great example, noted for having massive amounts of hydraulic and banks selling quite heavily into the US. They also are building a gas plant. So you start working, you remember my acceptable public acceptability chart, you know, they're already moving to the gas side, and I can see them coming more towards the nuclear side, and that's going to get interesting too. Alberta, I mentioned I was out in Banff last week talking about nuclear, and Alberta for the first time is starting to think about maybe nuclear has a place in the oil sands. There is a concern about the environmental impact of what they're doing out there, and there is also a pretty wasteful process in terms of the use of natural gas. So at least there's a willingness to talk about it. And it's a kind of sign of the times to me. I came back here, I got a call from a Calgary radio show that were doing a call-in, and they asked if I'd participate. Every single call I called in was positively in favour of exploring nuclear. I could not believe that. I was pretty sure that someone would have said, don't bring your stuff from Ontario over here. But none of that happened. It was very much a view that why wouldn't we look at it? It's technology is proven itself and we need help. We need something else. One of the things I mentioned earlier was this whole issue about planning ahead and thinking about what we do. If you look at Ontario right now, this is actually the Bruce Power Diagram. Can you ever do that? Is it coming back? Or maybe it can. Okay, so if you look at Ontario right now, it would look very much like Bruce Power does. When we came to the Bruce site, interesting story of the Bruce site. I don't know how much you know about the history of Ontario Hydro in the past, but the performance of our nuclear plants got in difficulty in the mid-90s, and they decided the way to deal with that was actually to take the older units out of service, Bruce A and Bruce B, and to focus the performance improvement on the remaining 12 reactors. Of course, the intention being we'll fix those up, we'll get better, and then we'll come back and restart the other ones. But when we took over the Bruce site, there were only 4 of the reactors operating. Ontario is short of supply. We look at it as any private sector business would. You know, we have a product, it's in demand, and we have the ability to make more. Why don't we do that? So we went ahead and restarted units 1 and 2. But actually, this purple section shows that every reactor on our site would reach end of life by 2019, and that's true of every reactor in Ontario. Without significant investment, every reactor would reach end of life. As a consequence of that, we negotiated a further deal with the province that would see us pursue the restart of Units 1 and 2, and that's a project that's ongoing now, $4.25 billion of investment. The project is working to actually return to service the remaining 2 units and then to refurbish all of the A units. But you'll notice that what that also does, it still leaves this situation where the Bruce B units are out of service. That doesn't make sense. So what we announced just a few weeks ago was the intention to pursue either the refurbishment of Bruce B or new build, with the intention of keeping our output stable at that level. filling that gap is $20 billion of investment. And if you add the Ontario Hydro plant to that, you can get to $40 billion very quickly. So it's a massive investment. And that does not meet a growing demand. That just holds the ground. So you can see some very significant investment requirement in order to deliver this. This is the energy supply mix recommended by government. As I say, they continue to see nuclear playing this role. I've said before, I've got some, you know, this is the current situation where coal, I've got some real reservations about closing all the coal plants. I'm not sure we can make that work. You share the concern about the environmental stuff, but nuclear plants are amongst the most flexible supply source we have. Nuclear can operate base load 24/7, but you guys don't consume energy that way. You know, you consume more when you rise in the morning, when you get home in the evening, and the elephant can't dance. We just do flat base load. But coal plants are incredibly flexible, and so I have not yet seen a technology that can do what coal can do. And we have to think about that as we go forward. This is actually how the government currently see the world. They believe that nuclear will continue to provide 14,000 megawatts, which is about 40% by installed capacity and about 50% by energy, which is basically what we're doing today. The big challenge that this directive puts in place is this one. I consider that to be a very, very aggressive target. Not even sure I know if we can get there. I think it's right to have an aggressive target, and the government have got to challenge us. We all have to challenge ourselves, because I can tell you that one of the first things I recognised when I came to Canada was a kind of lack of respect for energy. I come from a European background, and I was taught from a very young age not to waste electricity. Some of it was like that. Put the light off, son, when you leave the room. I remember when I was growing up, we used to have coins that you put in a meter for electricity. And my mother on a Friday evening would set all the coins on top of her mantle. A small pile. And midway through the week, she'd check to see how many were left. And if there was fewer there than she expected, then it meant one or two things. Either we were consuming too much electricity, or someone was nicking the 50 pences. In either one of those cases, you were in trouble, boy. But as I say, it was a good marker of use. You know, we had nighttime storage heaters that stored the power overnight, and you used it during the day. And Ontario, first time I came here, I was invited to a barbecue in August. I don't know, it was 30 degrees outside. We sat on the deck, the screen door was opening, and the air conditioning was trying to cool the whole of Ontario. And a lot of us do that. That's just the way we live. Like, some people say the only way you're going to fix that is by a massive price signal where it becomes too expensive to do that. But of course, the dilemma you have is, we can't actually burden our industry with that, because we actually lose our competitive edge. It's not an easy thing to deal with, and which is why I believe that's going to be a tough thing to do, because you're not asking people to conserve because it's too expensive. You're asking them to conserve because it's the right thing to do, and that's tougher. That is tougher. It's funny, I'm sure some of you know that when you come to another country, you see things in a very different way. Like when I first came to Canada, one, I noticed the energy thing, but two, I noticed the green bin, blue bin sort of waste sort of thing, which people actually do pretty religiously here. Whereas I've never seen that in the UK. The whole idea of separating glass and plastic and all that stuff, we never did any of that. We conserved the energy, but we didn't do any of that stuff. So here in Canada, we've taught ourselves to do that piece. So similarly, we should be able to teach ourselves to conserve power. But it's going to take some time. And the way I believe we'll actually meet our target is actually by imposing it. I.e., you can't buy a light bulb other than it's a low energy one. You can't buy, or maybe you get tax incentives for buying dishwashers and cookers and all those things that actually are more energy conservative in their nature. But that's a big challenge for us. And of course, the problem with conservation is, what happens if you don't make it? If you build your system on the basis that people are going to conserve and they don't, what do you do next? But I'll tell you an interesting thing about this, and this kind of highlights the political part of this. I remember speaking to Doc McGinty before he was Premier. He came to the site, we talked about energy. And he tried his very best to understand the energy position. Of course, by then he'd already made the, you know, we're out of coal pronouncement in 2007. And, you know, we talked about the doability of that. But nonetheless, that's what he had said he would do. And, you know, politicians always worry about breaking promises. So it's kind of hard to say, well, do you know what, I said that when I was opposition, but now I've added up the numbers, I made a mistake. You know, I don't know why they don't do that, but maybe that's why I'm not a politician. But, you know, the issue really is, if you were given a political speech recognising that your constituents are the people that vote for you, and recognising their preferences for solar, wind and all those other things, what kind of speech would you give? Vote for me, I'm going to build 20,000 megawatts of coal plants. You know it's the least popular, you're not going to say that. Vote for me, I'm going to build 20 new nuclear reactors. Don't think so. So what was the speech? What has been all of the politicians' speeches going in? We need to be more energy sensitive. We must care for the environment. We're going to invest in new alternative technologies, solar, wind, conservation. And if you think about what the Premier's done and what this government's done, and I'm not blaming them for it, it's a logical step, is let's do the things that actually we know you like. We're going to conserve. I'm going to give you all a meter in every home so that you can be responsible. But that also means, by the way, if there's not enough energy, what are you looking at me for? I gave you a meter. If you're not going to conserve, why is that my fault? Because you now share the problem with me. And again, you go right down that list and you get to, and by the way, we need some nuclear plants. Because up until then, people are with you and they say, yeah, I think we should close that dirty old coal, and yeah, I will conserve it. And now we need some nuclear, and so a few people say, well, I don't think so. But that's politics, that's the way it is. And I've always believed that, you know, it's important that we stand up for what we believe. And I've been in this industry 35 years, and I'm not ready to apologise to anyone for being in it. And it really pains me sometimes when the Premier will say, you know, I don't like nuclear any more than you do, but what can I do about it? It's hardly a glowing recommendation. Because what you recognise there is, without nuclear, you don't have a credible energy supply. We in Ontario have nowhere else to go. So we shouldn't apologise for being in it. In fact, we should be proud of the contribution we've made. Because I certainly believe we've got a lot to be proud of. So a couple of things which I had in just by way of additional slides, which really just talk about Bruce, but I've used most of my time and I wanted to leave 20 minutes for questioning. But a couple of things that just by way of information on our site, Bruce B and Bruce A. One of the things that we announced recently was the potential for new build. Actually, we've identified two possible locations. One is right here and one is right here. I have a view that there are five things you need if you're going to be the chosen location. It's quite interesting for me to look at the press now because it looks like there's a competition between us and OPG or Darlington or whatever where we build plants. And maybe there will be a competition. I'm not sure about that. But anyway, the interesting thing for me is there's five things I think you need to be a nuclear operator and be doing new build. Firstly, you need to have a community support, a strong local community support. I call it a social license to operate. You need that every day, but boy, you really need it if you're thinking about building new reactors. The reason I think it's so important is whoever builds the first nuclear reactor in North America is going to attract every anti-nuclear person that is in North America and then some. Because if they lose the first nuclear plant, then they know there are many more coming behind it. So it is a kind of lightning rod for all of the anti-nuclear activists. My view is Bruce County is the best place to deal with that. Because a very strong community. And, you know, I don't have to fight them off because the community will do that. Third-party advocacy is always better. Because people will look at me and say, well, you would say that. You're the guy on the site. So I think community support is absolutely critical to new build. Second thing, of course, is having the site location, the physical location to do it, and I've demonstrated we have that. Third one is actually having the skilled people and the knowledge to actually do it. I consider that to be one of our biggest challenges. We've got close to 4,000 employees. If I said I was going to build a new nuclear plant today, if I started shoveling the ground today, by the time that nuclear plant comes online, I will have lost 80% of those employees through retirement, because the demographic age is there. So, massive challenge, but also a massive opportunity, because if you build new technology, you know, state-of-the-art stuff, then actually it's a pretty exciting career. It's an exciting place to be. I can tell you, you know, I spent some of my career in plants that were being built. There is no more exciting time than to be on site during a highly technical engineering project, and particularly to see the plant from being first built right through to reactor going critical. It's incredibly exciting feeling to be there. So, you know, part of my job, I think, as the chief executive and indeed as the chairman of the CNA, is to present this compelling vision of the industry and of our company so that people see it as a career choice, because we have to actually meet that need, and that is not an easy thing to do, because demographics, you know, our own ability to actually entice enough people into it, which is going to be a challenge. The fourth thing you need is the cash. I told you, $20 billion. We're a private sector company. I'm very confident I can find $20 billion. Not personally. But, you know, I do believe that if you've got a good story to tell, you know, we've restarted units 3 and 4. They're running very well. We've produced 60% more output from the site than it ever has before. We continue to demonstrate a track record. Money will flow to good deals, provided you create the right structure. And the last thing we need is good transmission line, and that's one of the problems we have. We're not served well with transmission, and that's going to be a challenge for us. But big picture is, you know, if you're looking at this industry, you'd say it's on the rise. There's no question about it. Worldwide, it's on the rise, and that's been reflected in the position here in Ontario. It's challenged because we actually have been in sort of slumber in terms of design build. We've been operating, but we've lost a lot of our design build capability, and yet we're going to have to find it quickly. And that's a challenge for us. We have a demographic challenge as an industry. And the other thing which we should not ignore is the fact that there is only so much material available to meet world demand. If the Chinese are building, you know, 20, 30 reactors, a lot of the materials that they need are actually, you know, from the very same source that we need them. Specialised material, titanium tubes and your various components that have to come by. And so what I've continued to tell this government is make up your mind quickly, because governments think if they make a decision then it happens the next day, and that ain't the real world. We had to pre-order components for our steam generators 3 years before we made a commitment to do it, and had we not done that, we just wouldn't have had the components when we needed them. So I always tell people, you know, and it's not a selfish nuclear thing, it's just good planning. You know, think ahead and make sure that you at least keep your options open. And we haven't done that very well at all. It's the same true, we were talking earlier about university programs. We didn't keep our options open in university programs either, because the industry didn't plan enough ahead, and as a consequence, our programs declined. And now we've got, you know, we're trying to catch up as fast as we can to get people back through the pipeline. It's very short-term vision. I actually don't think private sectors actually have a short-term vision. I think they're much more longer-term, because they're trying to preserve their business. But, you know, it's been portrayed by bias, which is there are some things government should be in, and there are some things government shouldn't be in. And this is one of them they shouldn't be in my view, because they actually get conflicted with a whole set of other political overlays. So that's me. That's what I wanted to say. I'm happy to answer any questions, because I've got 15 minutes left. Yes?
The new reactors that they're proposing to build in Ontario, you showed a different variety of reactors that they're building across the world. What type do you think they'll build here in Ontario? Can you, or most other forms?
Yeah, it's a real good question. There are four reactor types that are out there that are vying for the world market. There's the AECL reactor, which is the advanced CANDU. Still in development, I would say. I haven't seen enough of it to actually see the product as complete. There's a Westinghouse AP1000, which is a light water reactor. It's seen by many to be the dominant reactor choice worldwide. It's ahead of the others. It's been licensed in the US, and it's a very solid design. There's a General Electric design, which is called the ESBWR. TES stands for economically simplified, which really means cheaper, boiling water reactor. GE are a big dominant force. Under Jack Welch, they kind of killed their nuclear program. They're back again and they're catching up. And I believe that GE, just because of the size of the company they are, will win a lot of the US market. And then there's the French design, the EPR. Now, if you think about it, recognising the choice of material might not just be technology, it might be political too. What are the things that would matter? Canadian jobs. You know, if I choose a French design and all the jobs are in France, that's not going to be politically tolerable here in Ontario. So you have to recognise it's not just about technology. You know, so what we've said we'd do in this next 30 months is we are filing an environmental assessment. We are filing what's called a technology neutral. In fact, we have filed it. We filed it Monday of this week. And what that will allow us to do is keep our options open. Government will ultimately make a decision on which choice, and they'll make it for reasons that, you know, some will be obvious and some less obvious. Because if you think about it, if AECL are to be a world player, Canada has to choose AECL. How hard would it be if you're selling your AECL design in China, Korea, and saying, yeah, my own country chose something else, but they were wrong. Yeah, this is the best. It's a tough sell. So there is a kind of destiny decision about, you know, what are Canada trying to do with their nuclear industry? I'm not really trying to judge that outcome right now. Our view is we'll take the next 18 months probably to talk to all of those vendors to understand all of the things that matter. The criteria will include Canadian jobs, export capability, world market share. Because one of the issues is, on the other side of that, suppose we did choose the advanced Canby reactor and no one else in the world builds them. I've now isolated myself from the rest of the world. I can't share experience because I'm the only person with this technology. Again, not a good place to be. So all of those things have to be valued. And you know, I'm kind of open to the options right now. If I give you the US view, US will be split between Westinghouse and GE. No doubt about that. I know that from speaking to my colleagues down there. So, you know, the market's going to shift around a bit. Yes?
What is the return on equity that the company provides?
Sorry, what is the?
What is equity return that the company provides?
Well, I can't tell you that. It's commercially sensitive information. Enough for us to make the investment. How about that? Better than a regulated rate of return. We're actually, I'm not being flippant on that. Right now, our deal is subject, the deal we just did for $4.25 billion is going through the Auditor General and his review of it. One of the issues we're going to have is, what is a fair rate of return for a nuclear investment? What do you think, since you asked the question, what do you think is a fair rate of return for a nuclear investment?
Well, depends how you look at it. 10%? 10%.
How about that?
I recognize the challenge for the coming from the demographics and improvement efforts. Do you have a short-term and long-term plan to address these concerns?
Yeah, demographics is a you know, if I look at it just from our own business, when we came to the site, the average age of our employees was 49. We had 3,200 employees and only 35 people under the age of 35. What a horrible demographic. And I'm going to make it much worse than that by saying that under our union agreements, people can retire under what's called the rule of 82, which means if your age in service add up to 82, you're out of town on an undiscounted pension. So if you think about it, I start work at 20, I can retire at 52. So I inherit the demographic average age 49, and you know, 2/3 of the population are actually eligible to retire in the next 5 years, and I've only got 35 people under the age of 35. And by the way, I'm trying to double the size of the business. So what have we done? We've recruited 700 people. In fact, we've recruited 1,100 people since we took over in May 2001. Whole range of people. The average age is now 46. We've brought in apprenticeship programs. In fact, we just announced last week a relationship with Fanshawe College. Yeah, we're doing other things. Of course, the Unini arrangement is to try and bring graduates in. We're trying to catch up, truth be told. At the same time, inside the business, we've done a risk analysis. We've gone through every job, skill, trade, and said, based on, we've surveyed everyone, when do you think you're going to retire? It's not a commitment, but give us some indication, recognising your eligibility. You're going to stay 1, 3, 5 years. And then we do an assessment of need. And then we're actively out recruiting. The challenge we've got is, firstly, we don't want all inexperienced people because the training burden's really tough. But at the same time, we want to deal with the demographic. And the bad news is the experienced people tend to have a very similar demographic to the people you are replacing. So it's really tough. And we're taking a challenge right now. We've increased our training arrangements quite significantly. We've brought in external people to do training. We've struck up a training alliance with the Power Workers Union. We have a training centre just off our site, which is training people. So we're trying to catch up, truth be told. It's not easy, and we're just trying to build programmes. And some of these Fanshawe College things and Unini and all those things are trying to rebuild the capability. If Duncan had his way, I would unite the entire operational fleet and I'd form a nuclear skills institute somewhere, and I'd train the entire new industry, the new workforce of the industry, in one place.
Do you want to have some investment in having that training in a university setup?
Yeah, but see, one of the issues, again, this is me portraying my bias, but I actually believe that the nuclear industry in Ontario and in Canada is not big enough to act separately. It should act as one entity under one single control, because you've now got a big enough checkbook, you've now got enough industry clout, and you've now got a longer term view, and you can start doing things. One of the things we've talked about in our own place is to say, what should Bruce Power do? Forget anyone else. Forget anyone else's interests. I could say, I'm going to recruit all my graduates from Western. I don't care if they're universities, I don't care what anyone else does. It's my single source, and we'll have a personal relationship, and I'll take all the graduates from there. That's one option. And that's sort of, I'm all right, Jack, and who cares about anyone else? Or you can say, we're actually trying to kind of spread the knowledge, expertise, and the skills across a whole range of organisations. I would tell you, from my own personal point of view, the jury's still out on that. Because I talked to Mike Lazaridis, who you will know as the CEO of RIM. Initially, they just went one place. That's where I get all my people. Till he got to the point where his reputation was such, he tells me he's recruiting from 362 universities now. People are coming to him because he's got a corporate reputation, and he's less concerned about that risk. So there's a kind of cycle right now of your brand recognition, which actually has people come to you. As I say, we're still kind of working our way through that. But the one thing that is absolutely certain, see, I say to young people, and this is a message for all of you to think about. I left school at 15 with no qualifications. Started an apprenticeship. And it was only after I'd been through my apprenticeship did I get a chance, fortunately, through my employer, to go back to university. How many people get that chance? But, as a consequence of that, I've been able to progress to where I am today. But the interesting thing is, if you look at our industry, if I could say to you, come and work at Bruce Power, everyone between you and me will be retiring in the next 10 years. Everyone. Every single person between you and I will retire in 10 years. So you can progress through this organisation at a rate which is determined by your capability alone. Nothing else. It isn't dead man's shoes. It isn't, this guy's a blocker. Everyone's out of town. There ain't many companies you can join and look up and say, those guys are all leaving and I can go as far as my capabilities will take me. Where's the application form, I would say? Because there aren't many industries like that. So that's why I always talk about opportunity and risk travelling together. Sure, I'm worried about the loss of expertise and knowledge management and how I can keep that. But at the same time, it's good to be able to move young people through the organisation and get them to senior positions, because then I can manage a demographic. And that's really what we're trying to do now, trying to shape that. And I'm also bringing people from out with our industry, because it's been a kind of introvert industry where we think, we're a specialist industry and therefore we can only recruit from the nuclear industry. I don't agree with that. We can recruit from the aircraft industry, we can recruit from a whole set of places that are used to regulatory environments, highly technically complex, but they don't have to be nuclear physicists. But I still see that as a big challenge.
We'll take two more questions from the students that are asking about the application forms.
I just had a question. In one of your slides had 15% for the right now, what do you think that number is going to be, Parker?
Probably the same, because we couldn't do anything in 5 years. But in terms of, you know, interesting enough, I was in Ottawa yesterday, but I just came in this morning, talking to some people there. What people are waiting for now is the new Harper government's view on the alternative to Kyoto. What does that look like? Now, you recognise that the Kyoto targets were unattainable. Most people do, frankly. You know, but at the same time, we have to do something on climate control. You're going to start talking about emission credits or something like that, which creates a different dynamic. And it's the dynamic that will actually create the supply mix, in my view. Because what you actually do is you say there is some form of preference for emission-free technology, and as a consequence of that, people feel that they can more readily invest in it. So I would tell you that, you know, when you look out in time, you're 10 years from now, 5 years from now, I would tell you that there'll probably be 6 or 7 or 8 nuclear reactors under construction or on order in Canada and in different parts of Canada. You know, if you look out to 2025, I think we'll be, I'm hoping, honestly, in 2025, we are actually starting driving hydrogen vehicles, because that's where I am. My view is actually, and the reason we joined the Canadian Hydrogen Association, first generator ever to do it, is I want the first nuclear plant I bring online to also be capable of making hydrogen to fuel hydrogen vehicles. Because you've got to actually think far enough. So that's my vision of the world. 2025, we're actually a lot less dependent on hydrocarbons for a whole lot of things. But we've got emission-free nuclear providing the hydrogen, and all we've got left at the end is water. That's my panacea.
Last question,
very easy question. How many people are you going to hire next year?
170.
170. We have people undergraduate, or masters, and PhDs. So what are the proportions are you looking at?
That's a bit more detail. I would tell you that based on where we are right now, we're short on engineering, significantly challenged in the engineering area. So, you know, I would say probably just proportionate to the numbers, it would probably be about 60 graduate level and 110 craft. That would be my guess.
Okay, with this, I would like you to join me in thanking Duncan for taking time from the studio. I would like to present to Duncan a small token of appreciation and something to remember about Western engineering. And this is not a check. but it's actually just an indication that Duncan has generously declined the offer of paying his travel expenses, so the Western Engineering has decided to make a donation to a charity of Duncan's choice, which is the Easter Seals, and so we have done, and we have a little indication of that there. I just want to tell you that we would like to maintain the conversation with Bruce, because we believe that our university may have a role to play in helping you, and you may have a role to play in influencing some of the things we do. We can think very creatively together, because one is, of course, the supply of new graduates, but other areas where we are getting more into is the training of people that are already within your company that may want to shift their level of competence to become maybe able to accommodate the changes in the dynamics of the system. So there are programs that we are trying to put in place where we want to basically hear from you what are your needs and what are the opportunities from our side to meet them. And certainly we are close by, and we are here to work with you in R&D, in provision of highly qualified personnel. And we really want to help you. I didn't feel any single negative question today, which means that this is a type of population that can actually help convey the message among the general public. And so again, thank you for being here, and let's continue to talk.